know, those wardrobe malfunctions that seem to plague most Greco-Roman statues.
Podcasting from an underground studio flying under the radar, this is Dan. By day, I'm a professor of cognitive neuroscience, and by night, I retreat into my subterranean lair and dig deep into the thoughts of mankind.
And I'm Dave, sitting firmly atop the Great Canadian Shield in Northern Ontario. I'm a pastor by profession, and a part of that includes unmasking the messaging that comes at us each and every day.
You're listening to the Not Conformed Podcast,
where we're tracking the reemergence of paganism in the West.
All right, welcome everyone to episode 17 of the Not Conformed Show.
Yeah, episode 17. There's just so much that's happened since our last episode, Dave.
Yeah.
For example, did you follow the release of the Afghanistan papers?
No, I didn't. I saw you sent me the link, but I didn't have time to dive into it. I just kind of looked at it. It looks very interesting.
Yeah, the Afghanistan papers are very important. We'll have to spend some time in a future episode discussing these papers because the revelations that are in those documents show how governments lie to their people about the true nature of wars that they engage in. They're an excellent example of recent governmental propaganda.
That's a great idea, Dan. I also have some material that will go well with that theme. In preparation for this episode, I got a little bit sidetracked into looking at these interviews with Yuri Bezmenov from back in the 80s, talking about Soviet-era subversion techniques as being used here in the West. And there's some really juicy clips that I want to share with our audience from that one. And then I also have some particularly egregious clips of children being brainwashed that I've been wanting to fit in somewhere. So that would actually make a great episode.
Yeah, we need to get back to the topic of propaganda and cover some of the political intrigue that's occurring around the world today.
Yeah, anyway, Dan, let's do a quick recap of last episode, since it's been a while, and outline what we want to cover in this episode.
Okay, so in our last episode, we introduced an idea, a thesis forwarded by law professor Stephen Smith, an idea he traced to the famous poet T.S. Eliot. And the idea is that contrary to the popular view that cultural struggles in the West reflect the conflict between religion, mainly Christianity, and secularism, the Eliot-Smith idea is that cultural conflicts in the West are best understood as reflecting an old and continuing conflict between Christianity and paganism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if this idea is correct, then we ought to see an increase in pagan practices and ideas emerging in Western culture today, right?
Yep.
Okay. So in the last episode, we defined paganism as essentially all non-Judeo-Christian religious beliefs and practices, and we focused primarily on Greco-Roman paganism, which would have been the dominant form of paganism around the time of the early church. And in the last episode, we began to identify pagan practices and how they're manifesting in our culture today. So we discussed how pagan polytheism is making its way back into the West, with statues of pagan deities showing up in the most unexpected places. And we discussed how animism, which is a belief that all objects have souls or spirits, and also pantheism, the belief that nature is God, are coming back into vogue.
Yes, and we showed how this is partly because of the increase of psychedelic drugs.
And we also reviewed various forms of pagan worship, and we noted how it's not so much about faith, but about enacting specific worship-related postures and rituals. And we identified yoga as one such posture-related vehicle of paganism that is popular in the West today.
Yeah, and we gave many examples of how pagan worship practices are being promoted in Netflix, especially the shows for children.
Yeah, I remember those clips, Dave. They were pretty awesome. And frightening.
Leviathan.
Exactly.
The generous deity of the sea.
That's right. And finally, we mentioned how some pagan philosophers viewed the pagan myths and gods as reflecting truth in a metaphorical way.
Yes. And this, of course, was the metaphorical and archetypal approach taken by Carl Jung and his protege, Jordan Peterson.
Yeah, Dave, as a quick aside, related to the point about pagan gods popping up in unexpected places, I've been prepping for my second year university course on physiological psychology, which covers the relation between mind and brain. And I was expanding the section on early modern neurosurgery, and I came across a detail that's relevant to our previous discussion. As I was preparing for my lecture, I read about the Montreal Neurological Institute and Hospital, abbreviated Neuro, which was founded with Rockefeller money in the 1930s. And I think it's now associated with McGill. And it was the premier neurological research institute in Canada. And maybe it still is. And as I was reading about this, I discovered that the main building of the institute has a statue of the goddess Nature in the atrium. Apparently, yeah, this statue was based on the goddess Isis opening her garments to reveal her bare face and breasts. According to journalist Luke Dietrich, this depiction of the goddess Nature is supposed to metaphorically depict nature herself, allowing science to learn about the fabric or the hidden realities of the natural world. And allegedly, one of the Institute's early logos contained a ram's head surrounded by Egyptian hieroglyphs. And according to Dietrich again, the ram's head was supposed to signify Aries, the astrological sign that in medical astrology, as I gather, is associated with power over the head and particularly the brain. So Dave, why do we keep seeing pagan gods and goddesses and astrological signs at our scientific institutions?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it?
Could it be that magic is just science we don't understand yet? Remember that meme?
Yeah. Well, when we get into paganism and magic, we'll come back to this, actually. Science, magic, yeah. That interacts in the Renaissance. So, by the way, before we continue, before we move on, I want to put a correction from last episode. I think, as I recall, near the end, we mentioned Leviathan is making an appearance in the book of Revelation, and that's wrong. I was listening to the episode just after it went live, and I realized immediately, no, that's no good. And to correct set the record straight, the Leviathan is mentioned directly only in the book of Job and the book of Psalms and in Isaiah, not the book of Revelation, unless you want to somehow make a connection between Leviathan, the sea monster, or the dragon of the sea, and then also the dragon in Revelation. But strictly speaking, the Leviathan is not mentioned by name in Revelation, so...
Did I screw that up, Dave?
I can't remember. I think you might have said it, and I just agreed to it, which was both our fault.
Right, I led you astray. Yeah. Well, you know, it's bound to happen because, you know, we're having a conversation on the fly.
Yeah.
And maybe I should also nuance one statement I made in the last episode. I think I said that the Egyptian god Horus was a sun god, but he's more commonly known as a sky god. Mm. And Encyclopedia Britannica notes that he was sometimes shown as a winged sun disk, so maybe a sun god in that sense. Mm-hmm. But in any case, I can't keep all these gods straight, so I'm bound to make some errors there.
Yeah, you know what? And actually, neither could the Romans. it became so hard to know because of all this giant pantheon and all these practices, what you had to actually do to be a pious pagan. And I've heard at least one historian comment on the fact that the simplicity of Christianity might have contributed to its appeal in those early centuries when the Roman Empire is transitioning from paganism to Christianity. So...
yeah, because there's only one God. Yeah. You don't have to worry about like 10 million gods. Yeah,
exactly. And you know, that's right. Now, what we really need to do is make it some kind of a crib sheet or find a crib sheet for these pagan gods, you know, to pull it up so we don't mess it up.
Yeah, that would help. Yeah, we'll make a poster so we can look at it while we do our episodes here.
Well, that'd be kind of weird. My parishioners walking into my study here seeing a pagan god's poster.
Yeah. Well, anyway, today we want to continue with the theme of paganism and how it's making its way back into our culture today. And we'll focus most of the episode on perhaps the clearest aspect of Western culture that is seeing the reemergence of paganism. And that's our culture's views and practices regarding sexuality. And to really demonstrate how pagan sexuality is coming back into vogue, what we'll do is, first of all, describe pagan views on sexuality, focusing primarily on Greco-Roman views on the topic. And then second, we're going to give examples of how these pagan views and practices are manifesting in our Western culture today. And then third, we'll discuss how these pagan practices contrast with the Christian views about sexuality. And we'll see that our discussion will hopefully take us beyond sexuality and into other deep issues related to free will and human value.
Okay, Dan, so we should probably give a warning right up front at this point, especially to our younger listeners. Let's just say if you're preteen, you should have your parents listen to the episode to first judge if it's appropriate for younger ears. We're not going to explicitly describe any kind of sexual acts. But we will be covering sensitive topics using the appropriate terminology. And so listener discretion is definitely advised. And I think we're probably going to mark this episode as having explicit content just to stay on the safe side and to provide a warning to our younger listeners or to our
to
parents and our listeners in general. And we should, we're going to try to add some section breaks throughout the episode as well. What we ultimately want to get to is being able to put markers in the MP3. And if your podcast client recognizes those, you're going to see that there's natural breaks in the podcast. But we're going to try to maybe play our Not Conform jingle to kind of show up the breaks. And if I can get that in the show notes to show, put some time codes, we're gonna try that as well, just to help listeners navigate the podcast more easily and make it. I know some of you look at a 2-hour show and you think, oh no, I don't have time to do that. Well, you can. There's a pause button. You don't have to listen to the whole thing at once. So we're gonna try to make it more manageable that way for you.
Okay, so let's mark our section break with a jingle. Here it is.
Show. Make sure you tell everyone you know.
Okay, so let's start our discussion of how paganism is coming back into the West with the topic of pornography. Now, in various parts of the Greco-Roman world, there was a shocking amount of pornography, or what they would call erotic art, and as Christians we might say obscene art. And a good example of how salacious the wall art could be, we only have to look to the Roman city of Pompeii, which was covered by the volcanic debris when I think it was Mount Vesuvius erupted in around 79 AD. And on the walls of the houses of the now partly excavated city, there seems to be an endless supply of nudes and people, and the gods, by the way, engaging in all sorts of sexual acts. And the erotic art would have been in full public view. Here is a quote from a CNN article on Pompeii published in January 2009. And in the article, they discuss a recently uncovered fresco on the wall of a house depicting a mostly naked queen of Sparta known as Leda with a swan on her naked lap. And the swan is supposed to be the god Zeus, who, according to Greek myth, interacts sexually with Leda. So the article reads as follows, quote, "This is by no means the only example of an ancient penchant for what today would be considered sexually explicit. Visitors to the house, or even those glancing in as they pass by, were first greeted by a fresco of Priapus, the god of fertility, weighing his exaggeratedly large phallus on a handscale to show his might and masculinity. Quote, this was another time in a different society. It was not so strange to show a masculine phallus, end quote. Osana, who, by the way, is the leading archaeologist at Pompeii, explained, quote, the people of Pompeii use this imagery a lot. If you go in the baths, they are full of explicit sexual images. It was really a society where sex was not something to consume just in private spaces. But it was before Christianity when the sense of sex was totally different," end quote.
Yeah, interesting.
So, yeah, sex was quite public in Rome. And he makes a point, which we'll unpack shortly, which is that this was a time before Christianity changed people's view towards sex and sexuality. And pornography in Rome was not only reserved for the rich. It turns out that even lamps, simple common household lamps, had erotic decorations all over them. And historian Kyle Harper, who wrote a fantastic book, by the way, contrasting the Roman, pagan, and Christian views on sex and marriage, writes, quote, "Lamps assure us that erotic art was not the preserve of the elite alone," end quote. So this was for everyone.
You know, Dan, I've always been a bit skeptical about the concept of artistic nudity in the ancient world. And I'm not talking about the explicit stuff that you just mentioned. That speaks for itself. I'm talking about those, you know, those wardrobe malfunctions that seem to plague most Greco-Roman statues, right? And also, by the way, Renaissance artwork, right? Like by the likes of Michelangelo.
Yeah.
And it seems like this kind of cultural saturation is always accompanied by promiscuity and sexual deviancy. The two seem just simply to go together all the time.
The work of Michelangelo, I think, is a good example of what we're talking about. There was a Guardian article It was published in, here it is, 2016, titled, quote, "The Great Cover-Up, Renaissance Nudity Still Has Power to Shock," end quote. And it discusses the cover-up of Michelangelo's work. Mm-hmm. Here's what it says, quote, "When it was unveiled in the Sistine Chapel, Michelangelo's Last Judgment was accused of being more fit for a gay bathhouse than the Pope's church."
Well, there's maybe a reason for that.
Yeah, and it goes on. "As soon as Michelangelo died, a painter was hired to cover the buttocks of his flying nudes with decent draperies," end quote. And the author, revealing his bias, by the way, goes on to write, quote, "Many of these idiotic veilings are still there. The Vatican has not allowed modern restorers to remove them." So the pagan author, I'm guessing, of this article wants the nudity back. So he doesn't like the fact that somebody had gone and covered up, you know, Michelangelo's great work. And the article goes on in a biased manner. It says the following, quote, "The same goes for Michelangelo's statue of the risen Christ in Santa Maria Sopra Minerva in Rome, which wears a ridiculous loincloth added after Michelangelo's death. It's all gratifying proof of the power and life of great art. The Renaissance is still dangerous after all these years. Just ask its censorious enemies," end quote. So you could tell that the author of that article wanted the nudes uncovered and all the genitals in full view. I mean, what can I say?
You know, I've never understood this kind of artwork in the church, because you see that in Genesis 3, when as a result of sin, man covers himself with fig leaves because he sees that he's naked, and then God covers him with skins of animals. Nakedness always in the Bible is associated with sin and shame, and it requires covering. That's part of the consequences of the fall. So I don't get this this all of a sudden kind of denial of that reality that pops up in the Christian church. I think it's maybe as a result of the Renaissance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, just Dave, imagine you're going to church and you're sitting there in church and you're looking around and it's just like pornography everywhere.
Yeah.
Just a bunch of nudes.
Bizarre.
Yeah. Like you imagine not being able to focus in that context. But yeah, I agree. You know, the well-known Renaissance painters like Michelangelo, I think, were subversively continuing the pagan tradition within the Roman church. They basically brought paganism back into the church. And the Renaissance could be thought of as a re-paganization movement. Mm-hmm. In fact, I understand that after climbing down from the scaffolding at the completion of the paintings in the Sistine Chapel, Michelangelo produced a painting of Jupiter, also known as Zeus, as a swan entangled with a naked woman who was supposed to be Leda, which is totally pagan. Remember, we just talked about that. That's one of the paintings that's in Pompeii, which would have been produced, you know, over 1,000 years, maybe even more before that. So Michelangelo goes from painting naked people on the Sistine Chapel to painting a pagan god sexually interacting with a human female. And the bias of the author of the Guardian article, because, you know, he wants the nudity back, exemplifies the struggle between paganism and Christianity, not only during the Renaissance, but also today. And Dave, I agree with you. This kind of art is at the heart of the issue, because an argument can be made that the visual pornography not only reflected the Roman views on sexuality, but it also shaped their promiscuous and sexual deviant behaviors. And obviously we'd say it's deviant from a Christian perspective.
Yeah, or from a biblical perspective. And as we'll be discussing, this kind of sexual deviance was the norm for the pagan Roman world. And as our culture becomes increasingly pagan in its orientation, it's no surprise that we're seeing more and more of this kind of sexual deviance being normalized in our society.
Yes.
Right. I mean, if you think about the movies and the TV shows that are popular today, nudity and explicit sex scenes have basically become the norm.
They're all over the place.
Yeah, you think about many of the shows on Netflix, right, which you've now canceled. And the thing is, with those shows, they're not required to be rated. So they get around the censors, and they've basically crossed the line to include soft porn in many of their shows, right? So they've become, if you want to stay away from that stuff, they've become basically unwatchable.
Yeah.
We previously talked about how this features in the Marvel shows on Netflix, but it's true for many shows on Netflix, including the new one, The Witcher, that heavily pushes pagan themes and concepts. And I'm going to save that one when we talk about paganism and magic, but I decided to check it out because it's billed as the latest Game of Thrones replacement, right?
Oh,
and so
yeah.
I wanted to check it out. And speaking of Game of Thrones, there's another very violent and very pornographic show.
Indeed.
Now, Dan, I got to tell you, I have not watched the show, but years before the show was even on the radar, I read the first book and I quit the series because of its pornographic and its violent content.
So even in the book, it's pornographic, yeah?
Well, the book, yeah. Like, one online reviewer joked that George R.R. Martin, it should stand for George Rape Martin. And the book is like the TV series. Very much so, or from what I've heard of the TV series. And I think I've mentioned this before in another episode, but I was listening to a podcast with Dr. Holly Ordway, and she's a literature professor that went from atheist to becoming Christian and wrote the book Not God's Type, which is a great read.
Okay.
But she talks about this idea of you can depict evil. And for example, Tolkien, he and Lewis, they went to World War II, so they understood battle, and so they can write battle scenes, but you can depict evil, you can write about it, and the audience can kind of see it, right? But it's not in a participatory way, whereas authors like R.R. Martin, what they do is they write these rape scenes, they write the violent scenes in a way that immerses you into the character and the character's lusts and urges and anger and violence and all that stuff, so that you go along on the ride. You are made to feel the things that the rapist is feeling. And this is a shift, and it's a very destructive kind of shift. And so I just said, no, this is, some online reviewer said, oh, if you were like the J.R.R. Tolkien, you should check out George R.R. Martin. Well, I did. And I was not, there's no comparison. This is a different spirit, a different character. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely don't recommend it.
Yeah. What you're saying essentially is that what these shows do, and maybe the book as well, is they put you almost into a first person perspective. So you're not in a third person perspective, getting a rough outline and an idea of what had happened, but you're in the moment, in the first person perspective. And so you feel much closer, you're involved in the act itself. And that could be very damaging.
Well, spiritually it is damaging.
Yeah. And I'm just looking here, Dave, on my screen. Time.com refers to Game of Thrones as the world's most popular show. That's a quote. And another article from Vanity Fair says, quote, Game of Thrones is even more insanely popular than you think, end quote. And it goes on to say that Game of Thrones averaged an insane 25.1 million viewers for its sixth season, end quote. So this is massive viewership that are watching this pornography.
And what's mind-boggling to me is that you even have conservative or even Christian commentators saying, oh yeah, Game of Thrones, got to watch the next episode. Well, we're talking about the effects of this pagan worldview coming back, right?
Yeah.
And this is definitely, like, it's a fantasy show. It purportedly takes place in a time, long ago kind of thing, or in a totally different setting, but it's meant to evoke, like, times before, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's meant to normalize those ideas back into our society, and the effects of it are damaging. Listen to this. I've got an article here. Listen to this. This is from LifeSite News. And the title of the article is Game of Thrones star Emilia Clarke, : rape scenes were terrifying, made me cry.
Mm.
And so this is one of the starlets, right? So by the way, Game of Thrones apparently featured 82 nude scenes in the first 67 out of a total of 73 episodes. So,
what?
Yeah.
That's and insane.
Listen to this, quote, the HBO fantasy show was in fact so aggressive in its featuring of nudity and sex scenes that the producers initially had to hire porn stars to play some of the characters because so many actors and actresses refused to do the scenes.
Wait, Dave, did I hear you correctly? They hired porn stars instead of the regular actors?
Yeah, yeah. Or they would sub them in or whatever, right?
And what do porn stars do? Porn stars do pornography, which means that what they are doing there is pornography.
Yeah. Okay, so here, you keep reading in the article, and apparently the effect of the show was basically to drive the viewers to seek out more pornography. Okay, listen to this. The sex and nudity in Game of Thrones simply triggered many viewers to go hunting for more, as the Daily Mail found that searches for Game of Thrones related videos and pictures of characters rocketed by nearly 370% on the day of the episode premiere. In fact, HBO actually sued a major porn company that was taking graphic and explicit clips from the show and simply uploading them on their porn sites as hardcore pornography.
So this is an HBO show, right? So this is just on TV.
And that's how they get around it, because I think it's just like with Netflix, they're a subscription based, and so they get around the ratings, right? They're not public broadcasting technically, right?
Okay.
But basically you have the mainstreaming of hardcore pornography into our culture with this this cultural phenomenon, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, really, when you think about it, it's with the advent of the internet, pornography has become easily accessible and basically has enslaved a lot of people.
By the way, Dave, you know, I remember hearing, and I don't know if this is true, we'd actually have to do our research, but I understand that actually in the early days of the internet, the reason why it started to become popular and used was because it was a way to share pornography. And I think the same thing is true of VHS tapes. Remember, VHS was very popular, but there was there was Beta as well at the same time, was another format in which you can watch movies. And apparently, I'm told that VHS won the day because the pornography industry was using VHS.
Yeah, that's what I understand as well. That's the story that goes along with that battle anyways.
Yeah.
And it's also the reason why tech pundits say VR goggles, that's what's driving those as well, right?
Well, there you go.
But you know, there are many who have testified to how extremely addictive pornography is. And I think one of the things that we're going to have to talk about maybe in a separate episode is about the neurological changes that take place when one watches porn.
Indeed.
Because we're seeing people addicted as young as, you know, 12. I've seen articles 8, 12 trying to quit pornography.
Wow.
And in fact, I've had several young guys come to me for counseling on this, and they're not even members of my congregation. They're just Christian guys who I've come to contact with, and they're stuck in this, and they want to get out. Or wives, you know, talking to them, it messes up your life, it messes up marriages, it messes up your ability to be sexually satisfied with a real life partner. And it's funny, it's sad. The porn addiction has reached such epidemic proportions among men and boys, and the growth market is actually even women right now.
And
actually back in 2014, this was a number I came across just recently, the industry was estimated to make $97 billion, the worldwide sex industry.
$97 billion.
Billion, whoa. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's gotten so bad that young men, and not even Christians, are starting to rebel against it because of how crippling it is.
Yeah.
One of the books I've got here, it's, I'll mention it later on, maybe when we get into how this stuff gets spread, but we went from the word pornography to porno to porn, which has become the norm. And it messes up your life, right?
It does.
I've got a great clip here because it shows how it messes up the actors who get sucked into filming this stuff.
Oh yeah.
So here's an interview with Emilia Clarke, who was 23 and fresh out of acting school when she got cast for a starring role as the Dragon Queen in the Game of Thrones.
Obviously, I took the job, and then they sent me the pilot. They sent me the scripts, and I was reading them, and I was. It was like, oh, there's the catch. Okay, all right then. But I come fresh from drama school and was like, approach this as a job. If it's in this script, then it's clearly needed. Then this is what this is. Mm. And I'm going to make sense of it. And this is my job. And that's what I'm going to do. And everything's going to be cool. So I kind of came to terms with that beforehand. And then going in and doing it, And I was in such a like other world of like, I'm floating through this first season. I have no idea what I'm doing. I have no idea what any of this is. I've never been on a film set like this before.
Yeah.
I've been on a film set twice before then.
Yeah.
And now I'm on a film set completely naked with all of these people. And I don't know what I'm meant to do. And I don't know what's expected of me. And I don't know what you want. And I don't know what I want, regardless of whether there'd been nudity or not. I would have spent that first season thinking, I'm not worthy of requiring anything. Mm-hmm. I'm not worthy of needing anything at all.
Right.
Because
you hit the lottery. You're lucky.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like, I have that anyway. So imposter syndrome times a million. So whatever I'm feeling is wrong. I'm going to go cry in the bathroom. And then I'm going to come back and we're going to do the scene. It's going to be completely fine. But it was definitely hard.
Yeah, Dave, this is really interesting because you really do see that... She is essentially a vulnerable individual, right? Fresh out of school. She's trying to get a job. She's trying to make it in the industry. And she's vulnerable and they're taking advantage of that and then abusing her as they her in this process of making the film.
Yeah, that's right. And notice, she's been brainwashed into thinking, well, if it's in the script and it's clearly needed.
And yeah, she's been brainwashed in drama school.
Yeah, exactly. And then she feels like, she's not worthy to require anything at all. So she's got to do it. Notice she said, whatever I'm feeling is wrong. I'm just going to go in the bathroom, cry about it, and it's going to be completely fine. In fact, when you read the LifeSite article, it says that doing nude scenes was so awful that she drank vodka and cried to get through it. And apparently the co-star who played her husband, Jason Momoa, who also was basically the one who was raping her in that very first episode, in the first scene, also had a hard time with the scenes, especially considering Clark's obvious discomfort with it all. The first rape scene that ran on Game of Thrones featured on the very first episode was awful. He was crying more than I was, Clark recalled.
Wow.
Right? And when she pushed back on doing these nude scenes in later projects, the producers tried to strong arm her, saying, well, you don't want to disappoint your Game of Thrones fans, do you?
It sounds like they taught her to disregard her conscience. And it seems like there's a vicious cycle here. They air nudity, pushing it onto the audience, and this inflames the desire of the audience. And then the producers cite the desire of the audience to goad the actors into even greater nudity, right? And telling them that the audience want it, so you therefore have to do it. And it's just like this vicious cycle. And you see, if we look back, you would see it just constantly ramping up over time, more and more nudity. And that's a slippery slope. That's an actual example of a slippery slope. And the way that it works is through a mechanism, like I just said, this vicious cycle, but also habituation. People habituate to lower levels of explicit content. They get used to it and they always desire a little bit more. And we know these habituation mechanisms, they're mechanisms that occur in the brain. And so the industry is exploiting this and continually ramping up the degree of nudity and explicit material to keep stimulating, essentially, effectively stimulating the audience. But in the process, they're goading their stars, their actors, into going along with it all.
Yeah, that's right. And in that interview that I clipped, it's a long interview, and she talks about later on that when, you know, years later, when she had to do a full frontal nudity scene, that she was, you know, I owned it, I did it, and it was me, right? And and she talks about the fact that the casting was way different back then, that 10 years later now, the casting is even different. They expect, you know, this is just absolutely expected of the actors now.
Yeah.
Right? So... yeah, absolutely, Dan. You know, we probably need to do an episode dealing with pornography and its effects on the brain, because that's definitely something you could speak to. But let's move on. Otherwise...
Yeah, Dave, I just have a jingle here that our young producers put together. Listen to this.
Mm-hmm. It's paganism all over again.
Just to make the point that all this pornography in the movie industry and all over the place is just the reemergence of good old paganism coming back into the Western culture. And here's our breakpoint jingle.
This is the Not Conform Show. Make sure you tell everyone you know.
All right, so continuing our discussion of the invasion of paganism into Western culture, and having just discussed pornography, let's consider how paganism is changing the way our culture views sexual promiscuity. Now, in the Greco-Roman world, there was a high level of male sexual promiscuity. And here's a clip from Professor Stephen Smith's lecture.
Romans assumed that an active sexual agenda was, for men, a necessity. Abstinence, or even the limitation of sexual relations to marriage, was unnatural and unhealthy. And pagan religion blessed this understanding. Sexual passion was a manifestation of the mysterious indwelling presence of the gods.
Our historian Kyle Harper writes that for males, quote, there was an unwritten law of youth. Sexual exploration was practically required training, after which it was expected the young man would cool off and ease into a more respectable self-control and eventually marriage, end quote. And there was a clear gender imbalance in this regard. It was shameful for freeborn women, the women not born in slavery, to have premarital or extramarital sexual relations. And from what I read, strict chastity was required of freeborn women in order to ensure that the inheritance would go to the man's legitimate offspring. So sexual limitations for women were born out of practical societal concerns that had to do with the movement of wealth down the male line. Now, here's where we need to do a quick aside on Marxism, because the Marxists argued that monogamous marriage was implemented by society because of this desire to pass on property down the male line. And you can read about this argument in Engels' book titled The Origins of the Family, Private Property, and the State. Now, in this book, Engels argues that early cultures were polyamorous. That is, people had many sexual partners and the community collectively raised the children from these relations. And as I mentioned, his argument was that it was the emerging desire to pass on property to the male's offspring that led to the formation of monogamous marriage.
Yeah, that fits Marxist ideology, and I've heard that argument, but I think at some point we're going to have to question how they arrived at that conclusion. Mm-hmm. And also we should discuss how, when we talk about Marxism, how Marxism weaponized this pagan sexuality in order to destabilize, specifically in order to destabilize Western society.
Indeed.
And really the rise of porn and promiscuity and deviant sexuality, none of this stuff just spontaneously arose in the West on its own. It's a deliberate agenda with a very specific purpose.
We'll have to delve into that argument more in future episodes because, of course, the Marxist goal was to dissolve the traditional family and eliminate private property, which is why they really liked the idea of group marriages where everyone had everything in common. But for now, the key point is that, at least according to Engels and the research he draws on, which may or may not be accurate, the pagan world had many instances of polyamory and various forms of what we might call group or collective marriage. And the group marriage wasn't really part of the Roman world, as far as I know, but it was allegedly characteristic of other pagan cultures. And what's interesting is that we're seeing various forms of polyamory coming back today.
Yeah, in fact, I've got an excellent article from the Daily Mail, and it was a headline that popped up on the Drudge Report back in December. And the title is A Polyamorous Woman 20 Reveals She Fell Pregnant by One of Her Four Partners After They All Went on Vacation Together. But she says they will all raise the baby as a family.
So Dave here, this is a situation in which there is a woman, not single woman, but one woman, and she has four male partners. Yeah?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh my.
That's right. Well, let me play you the clip.
This is Tori. She fell in love with Travis.
Woo!
And Ethan.
Oh my.
And Mark. And Chris. Their four-way relationship is working wonders for them.
The relationship could best be described by having Tori as the hub and all of us are spokes on a giant wheel.
But not everyone understands the dynamic.
I was like, oh, you're kidding, that you're joking.
How will this poly relationship cope with a further addition to the family?
And so who's the father of the baby?
So there's a thing there, don't judge, love, don't judge, during this banner music here.
Oh,
it
man.
It floats across the screen, right?
Yeah.
All right, so then this is mine and Travis's room. This is the master bedroom. This is the room that has the bigger bed. that people will swap in and out of every night just so that everyone can get equal turns, you know, sharing a bed. While this is like mine and Travis's room, we keep all of our stuff in here. People are rotating in and out.
Rotating.
The first polyamorous relationship I had been in was actually with Travis and Ethan. Travis was the one who had brought up the idea to me. We met back in elementary school. We've been dating for about 2.5, almost 3 years. I've known Ethan since junior high, and we made things official recently, but we've basically been dating for about 2 years now.
The term poly, meaning multiple, often refers to a three-person relationship, but for these guys, it's Tori and her four separate lovers.
And the next one would be Mark. We met in high school. And then Chris is the newest addition. We've been dating since April.
The relationship could best be described by having Tori as the hub and all of us are spokes on a giant wheel.
Right. Now, Dan, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
And I've caught this a few times in these kind of these episodes that have this kind of social engineering spin to them. But near the end there, there's a scene where the camera kind of pans up on a table and there's a stack of books.
Yeah.
And they're sitting kind of horizontally, and there's a bunch of multi-sided gaming dice on top. And then here's the titles. I had to screenshot and expand it to catch them. But here, Player's Handbook, Monster Manual, Dungeon Master's Guide, Xanathar's Guide to Everything, Horde of the Dragon Queen, The Rise of Tiamat.
Wait, what? Tiamat? Yeah. The Rise of Tiamat?
And, yeah. And The Call of, I don't even know how to pronounce this, Cthulhu or something like that. It's a Lovecraft, H.P. Lovecraft fictional demon deity. So there you go, right? Like when you watch these little segments, always watch, if they take a shot of a bookshelf, take a look at the titles, because that's part of the messaging.
Oh, yeah. I never thought of that. I think you deserve one of these.
Great point, Uncle Dave.
And by the way, Dave, did they say that it was the dude who brought up the idea of this polyamorous relationship?
It was, and that may be also something that's a little bit weird and shocking.
Yeah, and I saw, I was watching the video there, and those guys do look like a bunch of Dungeons and Dragons or Choose Your Own Adventure 10-sided dice rolling kind of guys.
Well, okay, so let's just put it this way. They don't look like they look like they're kind of from the bottom end of the gene pool.
Yeah, they're certainly choosing their own adventures. Yeah, Dave, we should probably clarify some terms here for our listeners. Yeah. So they use the term polyamory, which refers to having sexual relations with multiple partners. There's also the term polygamy, which refers to a person having more than one wife or husband at the same time. Then there's polyandry, which refers to the specific situation in which one woman is married to multiple men. And so this would, I guess, be a polyandrous situation, though we don't know if they're married or not.
Except it's illegal, right? And so they can't do it legally, but the concept is there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then there's also the concept of group marriage, which refers to a marriage between multiple males and females. And it would be this idea of this whole group thing that Engels and Marx would have attributed to these early pagan cultures, right? And it's actually an idea I think they were pushing for, because they want to dissolve the family. And because they wanted the state to be essentially controlling everything and everybody to be kind of commingling and equal. But in any case, I don't think you'd see this type of polyandry in the Roman world so much. But it may very well be reflective of other pagan cultures. But yeah, I think your clip, Dave, illustrates polyamory today. And I think we could say it's quite popular because people are having promiscuous relationships with multiple partners, which is really similar to what we heard in this clip. It's just that in the today's cases, the promiscuous relations involve people who are not in the rotation at the same time, or they're not in the house at the same time. and they don't have a commitment and this kind of collective agreement. But really what you're seeing is individuals having these serial polyamorous engagements, and we can call this maybe serial polyamory. But, you know, that's only a step away from this well-organized collective that we heard about from your clip. I have this interesting TED Talk clip here, Dave. This was a TED Talk viewed over 8 million times on YouTube alone, because you can access these TED Talks through different means. And remember, the TED Talk system is really the megaphone of sort of the liberal academic left, right? And this is a talk given by the psychotherapist Esther Perel. I think she might be Jewish. I'm not sure. But she deals with these situations. Listen to this.
Monogamy used to be one person for life. Today, monogamy is one person at a time.
That's the serial polyamory that I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, just listen on though. She says one more thing here. Yeah, they're laughing at that joke.
I mean, many of you probably have said, I am monogamous in all my relationships.
Did you get that, Dave?
Yeah.
I'm monogamous in all my relationships. But I think it nicely captures how we're moving away from a Judeo-Christian view of monogamous marriage, where you had two people and they were only partnered to each other for life, to this pagan view of marriage that you can do this multiple times over or multiple times all at once, and all these other creative arrangements.
Yeah, that's right. And I've actually got some clips here that will illustrate that even better. Going back to our... going back to the Daily Mail clip, you could argue, as I joked earlier, that it's the Daily Mail, it's a British gossip rag, and all these guys in this story look like they're from the low end of the gene pool, and you can just dismiss it, right?
They did indeed look like that.
But these kind of stories are popping up all over the place with almost programmatic regularity. Mm-hmm. And there's an article, this one is from CBS News. So this is now a mainstream American thing, right? Mm-hmm. And the article's titled, Things Are Opening Up. Non-monogamy is more common than you'd think. Okay. And in the article, there are several highly produced embedded videos, and it's a CBSN Originals documentary, Speaking Frankly, Non-Monogamy. And I have a bunch of clips that illustrate just how the producers are working hard to sell and to normalize these ideas. And if you watch the videos, I'll put them in the show notes, you're going to see good-looking couples, a bombshell interviewer, you know, everything you'd expect from mainstream media. This is not some kind of, lowbrow kind of thing. And so let me play the first one, which is kind of the intro segment of, you know, how they put the sound bites of various couples together. Mm-hmm. And then I've got two more that illustrate a couple of relationships and we could talk about them.
Okay.
We both, I think, believe that monogamy is something that we take with like a grain of salt. I have a girlfriend. Bridget has a boyfriend.
Yeah, it is a triad monogamous relationship, which is sounds kind of weird.
I am shocked at how common consensual non-monogamy is now.
It's not just about sleeping with each other's husbands, you know. Our lives are meshed together.
A lot of people think that, you know, when you're three people in a relationship, you're dividing attention. But we see it as we're multiplying the attention.
Many people are trying to create family in different kinds of ways, and I think a lot of people see that as dangerous.
My ex-husband is explicitly concerned. I think he's in that mindset. It's just not normal. This is not how it's supposed to be.
Giving somebody an out may give them an excuse to have a permanent out.
We're not here to just wreck the world and burn it down.
Dave, that sounds so good.
Well, it is. It's a big sell piece. It's a big puff piece. And so that was just the intro bit. Now here's I've got one clip that from this triad of a triad monogamous relationship, which is really just basically polygamy if they could do it legally. And then I've got another one from a polyfidelis closed quad is what they call themselves. So let me play that.
It's a triad monogamous relationship, which is sounds kind of weird. We do have the three of us, but we don't date anybody else. We don't see anybody else. It's not necessarily an open relationship.
Brandy and I have a relationship together. CJ and I have a relationship together. Brandy and CJ have a relationship together. And then there's all three of us have a relationship right. together.
So there you go. That's your basic polygamous relationship, right?
Dave, except it sounds so complicated, married. Man. I'm losing track here. Who's related to who? And I guess everybody's having a relationship with everybody, but not everybody else. I don't know. It's complicated.
Well, yeah. I mean, here's you want to complicate things? Here's another one.
Okay.
So we are a polyfidelitous closed quad. So what that means is that there are two married couples, two partnerships, and you can think about it like a rectangle. So I have my husband. She has her husband. Her husband is my partner. My husband is her partner. Like a square or a rectangle. Right? We don't date people outside of that structure.
It's not just about sleeping with each other's husbands, you know. Our lives are meshed together. Mondays, Thursdays, Saturdays are the nights we spend with our extramarital partners. And Sundays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Fridays, we spend with our marital partners.
Wow. So,
yeah, and these women, yep. I cut this out, these women apparently grew up in loving, stable, Southern religious families. All right.
Wow.
And you don't, these ones, you don't get to see their faces, just the back of their heads, because they're trying to protect their husbands, quote unquote. But from discrimination, and we'll get into that maybe a bit later. But notice the progression. And this, I should have mentioned this before the last clip was, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, we had Three's Company, right?
Yeah.
That was the comedy that was sort of, it wasn't about polygamy, but it was normalizing this idea of a guy living with two girls, right?
Yeah.
And now we've got this monogamous triad, right? Or polygamy, if it were legal, or this other thing here, which you called before. This is what you were talking about before when you said the group marriage, right?
Yeah.
Polyfidelitous,
polyfidelis
closed quad is what they call themselves, right?
We'll call it the rectangular relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's bring this back to Rome again. And it turns out that in the Roman world, there were various modes of and models of cohabitation. And I have a quote here from the historian Robin Fox. He writes the following, quote, "Marriage, finally, was only one social form of cohabitation, and it was valued because it legitimized children and eased the transmission of property," end quote. And we talked about that before. But then he goes on, "Many men lived with a partner as concubine, especially if she came from a different social class. The practice of living together had been greatly extended by aspects of Roman law," end quote. And so here we see that, in fact, you would have not only just regular marriages, but people would be, the man would be living with a concubine sometimes so that he didn't have to submit to certain aspects of the law that apply to marriages, right? So very much like actually today, people sometimes, you know, don't want to get married and instead just want to live together. Well, that was going on actually in the Roman world. But Fox goes on, he adds, quote, "Of course, there were also men who lived with a wife and a concubine at the same time," end quote. And so we see polyamory in the Roman world. And so this fits with our overall thesis that we're now moving back to the pagan view of sexuality and human relationships.
It's paganism all over again.
Now, Dave, I have a few clips here from a TEDx Vancouver talk given by a sexologist, as she calls herself, Jessica O'Reilly. And so again, remember, TED is the big liberal propaganda machine. I should tell you a little bit about this Jessica O'Reilly, because it's kind of important and interesting. She is an alumnus of the University of Toronto's Center for Sexual Diversity Studies. And she is, or was, because I don't follow these things, the host of Playboy TV's hit reality series called Swing. And I didn't even know there was such a thing. And Swing, by the way, refers to married couples hooking up sexually with other people. And she also has a podcast called Sex with Dr. Jess. And again, just to be clear, I haven't listened to any of these. I just listened to the TED Talk. But I think this background is important because it's useful to know who these ideas worth sharing, as TED's tagline goes, are coming from. On YouTube, O'Reilly's talk has received 3.1 million views. So she's very, very popular. Now, I have a bunch of clips. I'm going to skip some just for time's sake. But she basically makes the case that monogamous marriages are failing, monogamous marriage is restrictive, and we need to make a change as a culture. And she introduces a new relationship category, one that she calls monogamish. Listen to this.
Let's use monogamish to take the monotony out of monogamy in a way that preserves the sanctity, the safety, and the comfort of our relationships. So monogamish, what might this look like? Well, monogamish couples might look to extramarital sources for sexual stimulation, but only in thought, not in action.
So according to Jessica here, monogamish involves entertaining the idea of infidelity, but not fully acting on it. So what she does is encourage couples to sort of daydream about having a sexual interaction with somebody else, maybe even talking about it together, about having sexual interactions with somebody else, but not directly acting on that. Now, she says that monogamish retains the sanctity of marriage, but of course it doesn't do that at all. It completely violates the sanctity of marriage. And well, as she goes on, she says that flirting with someone other than your spouse is a monogamish activity. So as the talk goes on, we learn that there is some action involved. It's not just your imagination. It doesn't just involve the imagination. And near the end of the talk, O'Reilly, she encourages couples to keep pushing the bounds of monogamy. And she's quite explicitly coaching couples how to deal with any jealousy that might arise. And in so doing, she's essentially leading them down a slippery slope that will, I think, undoubtedly end their monogamy.
Every couple deals with these jealousies, these insecurities, these challenges in their very own way. Some take baby steps. They don't dive in to monogamish. They do it a little bit at a time. They might start by simply admitting to which celebrities they find attractive, right? It could take them years to work their way up to actually divulging their deepest, darkest fantasies. But these years, that process is what makes it hot. A little bit of fear and anxiety balanced with love, comfort, and security is the perfect recipe, not only for love, but for lust.
So there it is.
There it is. Yeah, that's the one, right? Lust, one of the seven deadly sins. And it shows actually the demonic agenda behind this whole
thing.
Because this is the whole problem with, of course, with watching pornography, because I mean, what she's advocating really involves couples watching pornography together, right? And then going off, doing even more kind of thinking about it. But I mean, this is exactly why you don't do that, because ultimately from a Christian perspective, we got to keep in mind Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, where he says, you've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart.
Yes.
Right. And then he goes on to say, if your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better for you to lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. Mm-hmm. Right. And so we'll get back to the scripture's view on this a little bit later. And I want to get back to this idea of lust as well and how it perverts sexuality a little bit later. But, you know, speaking of therapists, and this woman bills herself as a therapist, going back to that CBSN Originals documentary, apparently in January 2018, the American Psychological Association created a task force on consensual non-monogamy Okay, this is a task force that is designed to study this, to promote awareness and understanding of non-traditional relationship structures. So basically to guide therapists, mm-hmm. right? Which are, you'll hear this in a minute, biased against it, right? So here's a clip from Dr. Elizabeth Sheff talking about what this task force is all about.
They do a lot of great work in terms of not only researching what happens with people who are in consensually non-monogamous relationships, but making some best practices, guidelines and recommendation. If you would go in to see a therapist and they would say, oh, you are 12 different kinds of messed up and let's, you know, you got to stop having this affair and then we can fix you, versus, oh, I see that you're in a consensually non-monogamous relationship. What are you here to talk about?
Yeah, that's really interesting, Dave. I find it interesting that she says that there's research being done on this. And I think that the notion of doing any reasonable research on this in the short term is nonsense for a number of reasons, but maybe most importantly, that the key outcomes of interest would be likely long term, involving even mm-hmm. subsequent generations, the children of these couples and maybe even the grandchildren. And any useful data on that would take decades, if not more, to collect. And then, of course, it's unclear what the relevant outcome measures are, right? How you would actually index. It's actually very difficult to do research in this area. And I like the fact that she uses the term best practices. That's always a red flag. The best practices language yeah. means that you don't have any good practices at all.
Well, so you don't have any clear, yeah. like...
you're trying yeah. to whitewash it by saying yeah. best practices, which is like the better of the worst practices.
That's right. And Dan, I'm glad you mentioned the children, because I want to come back to that. I've got a couple mm-hmm. clips on that, right? Now, I've got several clips here from an interview with Dr. Amy Moores, and she's the co-chair of the APA's Consensual Non-Monogamy Task Force. So that's this task mm-hmm. force. And this is from the embedded video in that article that I'll link inside the Non-Monogamy Task Force. Okay, and the first one is the intro, and then which introduces her, and then I'll play her second clip as well. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Amy Moore is a psychologist and co-chair of the American Psychological Association's Non-Monogamy Task Force. I spoke with her about the goals of this task force and how research on the non-monogamous community is continuing to grow.
All right, so this is CBSN Originals, Non-Monogamy. Wow. All right.
Did you find it challenging to decide what criteria to apply when you were researching polyamorous relationships? In other words, I read some of your research and there were portions that indicated at the beginning it was challenging because monogamy has been set up as the gold standard for relationships, as the most satisfying and the most ideal type of relationship. So how do you break that down and compare it to a vastly different type of romantic and sexual relationship?
Yeah, great insight. And so in our society, it's kind of built up to the idea that monogamy is something that we should all be striving for. That's a milestone that we need to obtain. And so this idealization of monogamy and the priority placed on this idea that people should be achieving a monogamy also spills over into our science. For instance, a lot of theories on human development also prioritize monogamy as a stage in people's life and paint the picture that these relationships are sort of natural. So there's biases built into science that really prioritize monogamy when the research kind of suggests otherwise, that humans aren't necessarily living up to the ideals of monogamy as the way that it's portrayed to be.
Wow, Dave. You know, the notion of a bias towards monogamy, I think, exemplifies the cultural battle that's going on between the old monogamy of Christianity and this incoming alternative practice and the practices of paganism. And notice she makes the claim that this bias towards monogamy poses a problem for science. You know, people's yeah, desire that's right. for monogamy is thwarting science, Dave. Hey, listen, I think that's actually probably... maybe so far the best clip that you've played. I got to give you one of these.
That was an awesome clip.
So science is in trouble because of the Christian penchant for monogamy or Christian prescription for monogamy. But, you know, this task force is working hard to rectify this. Listen to this one.
In your research, does the data show that these types of non-traditional relationships are growing in popularity?
In terms of whether or not people's interest has increased over time, I did a really interesting study a couple years ago where I looked at what people were searching online. So many people use Google and we search for different things, often in an anonymous setting. And what I did was I looked at what people were searching for related to consensual non-monogamy. So things like what is polyamory or how do I open up my marriage? And I found that searches like that have markedly increased over the past decade. In terms of people's actual engagement or desire to engage, I did a study of that was representative of people in the U.S., so nearly 9,000 people took part, and we found that approximately 1 out of 5 people have engaged in some form of consensually non-monogamous relationships during their lifetime. And to help put that into perspective, that's really common, 1 out of 5. That's as common as how many people in the U.S. own a cat, or the number of people who speak a language other than English at home. So right. We're talking about, something that's actually really normative, yet highly stigmatized.
So really normative. 1 in 5, according to her research. And apparently that's the same statistics as those owning cats or speaking a foreign language in the U.S. And she concludes that non-monogamy is, quote, something that is actually really normative, yet highly stigmatized. Now, I hope you caught it because that's the same reasoning that we heard in the previous clip. And it's fallacious. It's fallacious. She's committing what's called the appeal to nature fallacy.
Can you unpack that, Dave?
Sure. The appeal to nature fallacy is the idea that it's fallacious to define good in terms of natural properties.
Okay.
So it's the argument that something is natural, therefore it is morally acceptable. Or also you can apply the converse, this property is unnatural and therefore this property is undesirable. So essentially she argues that because we're observing a lot of non-monogamy, you know, it's out there in nature, therefore it must be good. We should destigmatize it and we should normalize it and we should help people explore it.
Right. And what I find shocking here is that the 1 in 5 number actually makes this other point that this is growing in popularity, that this is entering people's consciousness. Yeah. They're looking about, and I'm still actually wondering how they're tracking people's Google searches.
Well, they have they can access the database of general Google searches, not necessarily individuals, right? But no, it's interesting. So you get she's a prof and she teaches, right? So here's what she, her approach and her influence and her students.
And you teach a class on gender identity and sexual orientation, correct? Tell us a little bit about the class and how it approaches the idea of non-traditional relationships.
So one of my joys at Chapman University is teaching the psychology of gender identity and sexual orientation. And in this class, I take a historical perspective to the field of psychology, and I focus on different themes. And one of the themes that we focus on is dating and relationships. And not just because it's my area of expertise, but also because I think it's really important for college students who are brought up in a really sex-negative culture to understand that there are different types of relationship options for them. I present the evidence, I present the science on casual relationships, on hookup culture, on polyamory, on swinging, and I allow people to be exposed to this type of information and to make decisions for themselves in terms of maybe what they want to implement in their own personal life, but also to be a critical thinker and to enter the world as a citizen that may hopefully be less biased towards people who might be different from them.
Dave, she says that she takes a historical approach. I'm thinking, hey, we are taking a historical approach in this episode, right? Pointing out that people like Moores are reintroducing to us the historically pagan and non-Christian views on sexuality and marriage. And I'm still trying to figure out what the word sex negative or the concept of sex negative really means.
Exactly. That's right. And how exactly we're in a sex negative culture, given that this is all, raging hormones everywhere on university campuses. I'm not quite sure either.
I think she's introducing a negative sex culture.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. And it goes on, and it's very clear that this task force really is about normalizing this stuff and in therapy and urging therapists not to discriminate against this kind of stuff. That's what it's all about, yeah. Really.
Yeah, indeed.
But I want to get back to...
Yeah, indeed. And the fact that it's being introduced in the classroom now, and this is a person who is an authority on this. They're viewed as an authority. I mean, it just shows you where academia is going, the direction that it's going mm-hmm. in with regard to sexuality, and it's going in the pagan direction.
Yeah, that's you just have to go to, I think it's Campus Reform, if I'm correct, the online newspaper, and you just see the articles and what's being pushed on campuses all around the mm-hmm. country. But I want to get back to, you raised the issue of the kids. Well, what about the mm-hmm. kids? And I have a few more clips from another video in that article titled Children of Polyamorous Relationships. And this first clip, again, introduces the expert. Her lower third reads, Dr. Elizabeth or Ellie Sheff, sociologist, mm-hmm. expert on children in polyamorous families, right? That's mm-hmm. That's her lower third. So this is the intro once again, and then we've got a few clips and sections from that interview.
Welcome back. I'm Tanya Rivero. Our conversation about our CBSN original documentary, Non-Monogamy, continues with Elizabeth Sheff. She's a sociologist, author, and expert on children in polyamorous families. She's been working with several poly families for nearly 20 years. I spoke with her about what she learned in her research.
All right, so what did she learn?
Yep,
here it is.
So in your research, children have not had any particular difficulty dealing with this any more than children have difficulty dealing with other life issues?
I would say sometimes children do have a difficulty dealing with it, much mm-hmm. in the same way that children who have same-sex parents sometimes feel uncomfortable being different at school or something, and they're different because of their parents mm-hmm. specifically. The difference with polyamorous children is that polyamorous families tend to really blend in to society because so many children have divorced parents right now that it's very common for a kid to have mom and her new husband and then dad and his new boyfriend, and they're all coming to right. the soccer game or something like that.
Yeah, Dave, this is really interesting because she says that children do have difficulty dealing with these relationships. So she actually acknowledges that there's a difficulty.
Yep.
That's right. A related point here, she makes the case that with the high level of divorce and remarriage in our society today, children are essentially already experiencing a polyamorous family situation because they go mm-hmm. to, you know, the soccer game and there's these multiple parents that are all kind of their parents.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And it's funny because this is a puff piece. And what I mean by that, it's excessively complimentary and sugar-coated on the whole topic. And I've got three little clips, short clips from a much longer interview. But when push comes to shove, she has to admit, even in this puff piece, that there are problems, yeah. right? This next one talks about divorce. All right. So let's listen to this one.
All right. Well, because I do imagine that poly families split up just the way monogamous ones do sometimes, correct?
Poly families not only split up like monogamous ones, but sometimes even more spectacularly.
Right.
One of my children respondents called it divorce on steroids because all four of his parents divorced each other kind of spectacularly over time.
There you have it.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, this is what's going on. And, you know, Michael Snyder on the Economic Collapse blog, he's got an article that went up in December 15th, the destruction of the family. The U.S. has the highest rate of children living with a single parent in the entire world.
Wow.
All right. And so he talks about how this, you know, it's an analytic piece that talks about how this is destructive of society. And the shocking thing is the U.S. has the highest rate of children living with a single parent in the entire world. This is the consequences of when you start mucking around like this, because these are not stable relationships, right?
Yes. Yeah.
The stuff goes off the rails, and then it's divorce on steroids, like the kid
Yeah. And right? then I think, you know, this is for another episode, but once you dissolve the family in this way, you can have the state really influence the individuals because you no longer, the state doesn't have to work against a very strong family unit. And that's when you get a lot of control of individuals.
And people become dependent on the state because the state is all that's left. Yeah. We talk about that in the Marxism episode. That's super important to mention. Now, you know, one of the questions that obviously the interviewer is going to have to ask, and she does, is what happens to the children of these relationships? Are they going to be polyamorous as well? And so that's my next clip.
And in your experience studying the children, are they more or less likely to engage in non-traditional relationships when they reach adulthood?
You know, most of them are not sure. Yet, when I ask them if they think they'll be polyamorous themselves, some of them say absolutely, at minimum polyamory. Others say under no circumstances. The majority of them, however, fall into this kind of middle category of not right now, maybe later we'll see.
Yeah, so you're seeing an influence even on the next generation. It seems like the children are very confused.
Yeah. So of course the kids are going to be influenced because that's the model that they're experiencing. They don't know normal. This is the normal for them, right? Now, that was a puff piece, like I said, and it was very positive from this therapist expert, right? Now, the most honest response, though, came from one of the moms in that Polly Fidelis closed quad when she was asked about the question about the kids' responses. And I think this is the one to end this little segment on this.
We talked for a very long time about doing this before we did it because of the kids. It's one thing to go off and live your adult life. It's another thing to destabilize a child's life. And so we had to decide really early how we were going to deal with being open about the nature of our relationship without saying, kids, sit down. We have something to tell you. We're all very strange here. Here's how.
So how did that conversation go?
I believe her exact words were... Someone has got to explain this madness to me. That's a literal quote.
And I don't know if you caught it, but the lady that said that, she laughs. It's a nervous laughter and it's almost got a cry in it.
Yeah, because the kids here, they realize this is all bizarre. And it's interesting that the parent there sort of says, well, we thought about this because of we're concerned about the children. The child says, this is bizarre, but they go with it anyways. They disregard the child in the end because you know what? It's not about the child. It's about their own drive. It's about their own desire. They make it sound like they care about the child, but in the end, they totally disregard what the child is thinking.
No, the kids, they just got to adjust.
Yeah.
Get with the times, you know? And you know, with this kind of normalization of non-monogamy, I'd be willing to bet that the next step is to basically continue to normalize it and then to include it as a protected class along with all the other sexual orientations that are going on. And in fact, I got one more. This is the last clip of this from this whole article. But there's another segment with a lawyer on it. And this is a clip with a lawyer. Followed by a kind of a pull your heartstrings appeal to help you think, oh yeah, these people really should be protected as a class. Listen to this.
There are places where it's not safe to tell people that you're polyamorous, and many people are not out. I've seen clients lose jobs because they're polyamorous. I think employers are aware that they don't have to allow employees to express themselves in terms of their relationship status because that isn't a protected class.
I had an anonymous note written to the school board, to the district office, and my district called me in and said, what's going on? You know, what's the problem? Do you need to tell us anything? I was like, no. I was like, I'm in an open relationship, but that has no bearing on me as an educator. And they were like, that's fine. We believe you. We don't have a problem with it. I was terrified that I would be let go from my job or that I would have people that wouldn't accept me. My students, like, they give me oxygen, like, they give me life. And so to have that taken from me would have just, like, devastated me. So I was just very aware that that could happen. and that I would have nothing. And how could I provide for my kids if I don't have a job?
Well, they're so oppressed. Yeah. This is reminds me of the victim Olympics. I'm so scared of my
oppression Olympics. Yeah. Well, and this is she's a teacher. Okay. She's a teacher. Right. And so, you know, especially the primary school teachers, they have a tremendous influence on their children. So, you know, my prediction is this is where it's headed. In fact, I think there's good evidence for it that they're going to be looking at legalizing and normalizing and protecting, these situations. And if you watch some of the other videos, the polygamous ones, the guy divorces his wife so that he can marry the other woman because she needs immigration status, but they're all three still living together. And it's a complete gong show, right? But this is where we're heading in society. And, don't be surprised when you start seeing this popping up again, another example of paganism coming back into the mainstream.
It's paganism all over again.
Well, Dave, as I prepared for this episode, I asked myself, why were the Romans so permissible with regard to sexuality? Mm-hmm. And it turns out that in the Greco-Roman world, people believed that sexuality and sexual impulses were determined by forces from outside of the person, including even the motion of the heavenly bodies, such as the stars and the planets. Now, in the Roman view, a guy could exert some degree of control over his sexual impulses, but that control was limited. And some even believed that the movements of the planets would determine a person's sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. Along these lines, Kyle Harper mentions the astrological writings of Ptolemy, who was considered one of the preeminent scientists of his time. And evidently, Ptolemy believed that, and here I'm quoting Harper, quote, "The difference between men and women is one of degree rather than kind. Masculinity and femininity stood on a single sliding scale," end quote. And I think this is very interesting because this is similar to the view coming into vogue today. And quoting Harper again, quote, "The pull of planetary forces might draw men and women alike toward either the masculine or the feminine end of the spectrum," end quote. Mm-hmm. So the key point here is that the Romans believed that people did not have free will when it came to sexual control. The Romans felt that they had to create opportunities for men to gratify their sexual desires because full self-control was deemed to be simply impossible. Sexuality was determined by forces outside of the person, according to the Romans.
Yikes.
And I think we're seeing forms of this determinism invading our culture today, perhaps chiefly in the form of genetic determinism, which is evident when people say things like, "I was born that way. I have this sexual preference because I was born that way." So now it's not that the stars made me do it. It's my genes that made me do it.
Yeah. And getting back to this, you know, you can't fully control your desires. There was an article, I guess this was the second time they ran it. It was in the Telegraph. Why men should give their wives a cheat pass this Christmas. Now, it's behind a paywall, so you only get to read a little bit of it. And I got more information out of from a critical Breitbart article out of it. But here's what in the Telegraph, what they had. Wednesday Martin, whose latest book, Untrue, explores, quote, "Why nearly everything we believe about women and lust and infidelity is wrong. Is not being flippant. We now know long-term relationships are harder on female desire than they are on male desire," she says. Many, da, da, da. So I wasn't going to pay them to read it, but there's a link to the critical article from Breitbart, and you can Google it. It's elsewhere as well. But this whole idea that somehow, you know, the women need a cheat pass because they just can't control themselves and it's harder on them and all this. Again, these pagan ideas, like you just mentioned, that's what's behind it.
That's right. It's like you can't fully control yourself. You need this. It has to be in place so that you can, you know, allow your needs to be met, and you have no control over them. They're driven by your biology or your genes, or if you're a Roman, the movement of the planets.
Yeah, and what's bizarre, you pointed out before with the girl with the woman with the four guys. But where the guy introduced this, but the bizarre thing is that we've got these males you know, these beta males in society today, which are being taught that it's good for you to watch your wife or your girlfriend have sex with other guys. This is just weird. I mean, it must come out of pornography.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, David, we should clarify that we've been maybe somewhat carelessly switching back and forth between Greco-Roman sexual promiscuity and the sexual practices of other pagan cultures, those described by the Marxists like Engels. The Romans, they allowed for some polyamory, particularly in the sense of Roman men having a wife and a concubine and having sexual relations with prostitutes. But the Romans would look down on passive emasculated males who would be willing to share their wives. Mm-hmm. It's allegedly other pagan cultures that let polyamory of all sorts run rampant.
That's right. One of the points that is made by one of these researchers in the articles that where I was pulling the clips is they talk about how this is a mark of essentially the West, where women are more emancipated, both first of all financially, and then more empowered to do this. And so mm-hmm. we have a kind of an egalitarianism in the promiscuity with both men and women. And so you find this mostly in Western societies.
Yeah. So this might be a growing innovation that's occurring, that's going yep. beyond Greco-Roman paganism. But Dave, I'm looking at our time here. And again, we're getting quite long in this episode, but we have still so much to cover.
Yeah, I'm looking at the outline and we're the next segment is supposed to be on slavery and prostitution and homosexuality. And I get some great clips there. And then pederasty and abortion. And of course, we really want to get into the Christian impact on pagan society and the Bible's view on these kinds of things. So I think we're going to have to leave this off for the next episode, Dan.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to do so. Maybe I'll just end off here with a summary and then you can take us out. Does that sound all right?
Yeah, we better do that.
Okay.
It's just going to be another monster episode otherwise.
That's right. Okay. So in summary then, we've been making the case that paganism is on its way back into Western culture, and that one cultural sphere in which this is blatantly evident is in the area of sexuality and marriage. We discussed how public pornography and sexuality was in the Greco-Roman world and how much of this is coming back today. We also talked about the pagan practices of polyamory, some forms of which were present in the Greco-Roman world, but other forms were allegedly present in other pagan cultures. Regardless, all these weird practices seem to be on their way back today, and people are bringing them in with considerable enthusiasm and with some innovation. And so hopefully in the next episode, we're going to continue to expand on this and get into the other topics that you mentioned, Dave. So why don't you just take us out?
All right, Dan. Well, I want to first of all, once again, thank all our listeners who have sent us links and sent us email. I've got a couple of great little articles from you guys that I'm going to pull into the episode. I guess not the next one, which will be a continuation of this one, but when we get into magic and paganism and witchcraft.
Ooh.
So thanks again for sending that. And, you know, I want to just again ask our listeners, if you find articles on witchcraft, which is where we're headed, we want to, or Marxism or propaganda, that's kind of the next little, our targets for the next little bit. And even if you find great audio clips, now you don't need to clip it, just send us a link and a time code and we'll do the clipping so that you don't have to worry about the technical aspect of it. But we really appreciate those kinds of things because they leverage our ability to bring interesting stuff on the show. So just send us an email to info@nutconform.show, and I can't promise I always respond. I can't even keep up with my regular personal email, never mind the show email, but I do read it and I do appreciate when you guys send stuff in. So that's info@nutconform.show, and you can find us on the web, of course, at nutconformed.show, where you'll find the episode, the individual episode pages and show notes and subscribe links. And that's the way to spread the show or to listen online with those great embedded players. So get the word out, nutconformed.show or info@nutconformed.show as an email. And that's it, Dan.
All right. I'll talk to you later, Dave.